This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Details from pictures and witnesses from a now quiet field of tragedy in eastern Ukraine. A pink children's book, a parking ticket, an Asian travel guide lying in the mud, book of stickers, children's playing cards near a road, Nivea skin cream no longer connected to a real person's skin, a razor lying randomly separated from the face it was purchased to groom, white slippers, bottle of cologne, blue blanket in a red suitcase impaled on a metal pole, a bicycle lying in the grass. All details from the New York Times and other news reports and pictures of the crash site of Malaysian Flight 17, the plane brought down yesterday apparently by an advanced surface-to-air missile. War and its consequences, seen and unforeseen this hour. That's how the big stories in the world line up without a lot of prompting on our part. You'll see what I mean as we also follow the situation in Gaza. But we begin this hour with the latest in the Malaysian airline tragedy, Flight 17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, that region where the plane came down, eastern Ukraine, in the middle of its own separatist conflict being conducted on land, sea, and air. It is a war zone. We go now to Kiev and Andriy Kulikov, Public Radio Ukraine correspondent.
Well, the feeling of shock is still overwhelming. No one, I would say, expected this thing to happen. And of course, the bits of information that we gather from public sources are not enough to put together an eloquent picture. But I was at the briefing given by the State Security Service, and he made public some details that, from the Ukrainian point of view, prove that it was not the Ukrainian armed forces that shot down the jet. There is also some information that says now that the anti-aircraft missile complex that may have shot down the plane is being transported back to Russia.
Interesting. Does Ukraine have any kind of capability equivalent to the Buk missile, which people are talking about as the possible culprit here, the long-range surface-to-air missile that may have shot down this plane?
Ukraine admits that Ukrainian armed forces had these missiles, but all of them are on the territory that is being temporarily controlled by the militants. So the Ukrainian official viewpoint is that the Ukrainian armed forces do not possess this kind of weapon at the moment, and they did not possess this kind of weapon yesterday when the tragedy happened.
But let me focus on that detail. So are you saying, and are Ukrainian officials saying, that separatists may have stolen these weapons from Ukrainian stockpiles that originated in Russia at some point?
Well, this is one of the theories, but it is not applied to the current situation, because the head of the Security Service of Ukraine, Mr. Nalivaychenko, has explicitly told that the suspected anti-aircraft missile complex was taken into Ukrainian territory across Russian border yesterday at approximately 1 a.m., and then transported to the vicinity of the town of Pervomaisk. And there it was allegedly used to down the Malaysian airplane.
So it's conceivable, and again, this is just a theory, that the missile battery originated in Russia, was acquired by Ukraine, ended up in the hands of eastern Ukrainian separatists who took it across the border into Russia, Russia perhaps wanting to retake that missile because it was so dangerous, but then the separatists brought it back over the border. That's what this theory would suggest.
Well, actually, the theory suggests, and the head of the State Security Service was very positive, that the crew of the missile battery was composed of Russian servicemen. He says that it is an established fact and that Ukraine will demand from Russian authorities the surnames of these people to be made public and to be used in an investigation that the Ukrainian side launched and to which it invited international experts.
What do you make of the reports that the separatists claim possession of the flight recorders of the downed jet, and the assessment from Moscow that this is some kind of a unforeseen accident or the various Russian explanations that we're hearing already?
The claim by the separatists that they have flight recorders may well be true, because today Ukrainian official spokesmen were very reluctant to speak on the matter. Another thing is that Ukrainian spokesmen say that armed separatists are intruding with the work of emergency services on the site of the tragedy. And when asked who is actually recovering the bodies and maybe the fragments of the plane, they said that they cannot confirm that those are Ukrainian emergency services workers, because as a spokesman from the Ministry for Foreign Affairs said, anyone can don a uniform.
What do you make, or what does the government say in response to Vladimir Putin's suggestion that Ukraine created the conditions for this crisis?
I haven't heard any comment on this score from the government officials, but I would say that the general public is absolutely indignant about this allegation, because even if there is, well, and we know that there is trouble in the east of Ukraine, most of people here think that it was instigated by Russia.
Andriy Kulyakov is Public Radio Ukraine correspondent. He spoke with us from Kiev. Andriy, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Joining us now, David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, John.
So what do you think, David? In this eerie week, are these events, the incursion in Gaza and Ukraine, are they news distractions unrelated to each other, or a sign that the whole world temperature is bubbling up all at once?
They are bubbling around the world, but I'm not sure I would necessarily say it's on a concerted level. I mean, there is an argument to be made that as the United States has pulled back from Iraq and Afghanistan and has indicated that we're not going to go into every conflict around the world, that that opens the way for separatist movements, for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for Vladimir Putin to try new adventurism. But to some degree, many of these conflicts aren't about us. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict obviously long predates our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan and our withdrawals. The Russian effort to show its muscles around the world here, I think, are also more to do with Putin's return as president and his feeling that Russia got the worst end of the Cold War than it does anything in the current moment. So I think the big question is, what can the United States do to moderate these forces without getting in on the ground? And that's a very hard balance.
Is it possible that the real headline in the Ukraine story is, on some level, proliferation, in that the capabilities of these long-range surface-to-air missiles are proliferating? They're in the hands of people that we would not expect to be actors, but suddenly are. And that, this is a very different kind of event than, say, the Korean Airlines 007 event or the shooting down of the Vincennes over the Persian Gulf decades ago. We'll find out who actually shot this plane down, but it's a proliferation story.
It is, and I think that's important to remember, because the trend over the past 20 years has been that more and more powerful weapons have fallen into the hands of non-state actors. And if you're wondering why it is that the United States is so worried about, say, the spread of nuclear weapons in Pakistan and their move to smaller nuclear weapons, it's because it's not hard to imagine a separatist group in Pakistan or an extremist group getting a hold of that arsenal. And if you're looking for evidence of that, when this is all done, and we still don't know exactly who shot the missile that brought down the Malaysian airliner yesterday, it seems likely that we're going to discover that anti-aircraft missiles that were once in the hands of a state were overrun and put in the hands of individuals. Now, that said, they're not easy to launch, and it does raise questions about whether or not there was state help from Russia or from Russian actors who may not have been acting with the knowledge of Putin's government. We simply don't know that yet.
Although, again, thinking ahead, as you always do, does this raise the possibility of a forensics process where the international community will create rules and norms where nations that produce these kinds of weapons will be held accountable for the provenance of them, the training of individuals who end up using them, and that people like Putin and powers, even including the United States, will be held accountable?
It would be nice to think so, but so far our efforts to do that have largely failed. And think about the three areas where you try that the most. The one is in these anti-aircraft missiles. And, you know, the reason that the CIA was in Benghazi when the awful events happened there 2 years ago was to try to soak up the anti-aircraft missiles that were floating around Libya. The reason that the United States worked so hard on trying to get to nuclear forensics is so that you could hold a state responsible. But it's very difficult to imagine, John, I think, that if a nuclear weapon went off somewhere and it was ultimately traced back to ownership in some other country that lost control of it, that you would retaliate against a country that merely lost control of something. That's the difficulty. And the real area where this is hard is cyber, where it's extraordinarily difficult to figure out who a cyber attacker is, whether they're being run by the state or not.
We've talked about just a little bit earlier this hour. Is the story in Gaza possibly the fact that Israel has called Hamas's bluff? If Hamas wants to go it alone, they're going to have to go it alone without the help of Egypt and without the help of the Palestinian National Authority.
I think that is part of the story. But I think the other part of the story that worries me is it's not entirely clear how the Israelis then come back out of Gaza with the confidence that they have a permanent solution to the problem. In other words, what we've learned in Gaza is you go in, you look for these tunnels, you destroy the weapons, you come out, and you discover that Hamas gets resupplied. And so I think the hard part that I have not fully understood in the Israeli strategy is once you've gone in and done this, how do you know how to disengage? Because obviously they don't want to be in a position of permanently occupying Gaza again. They've tried that before.
So before we go, since we are talking about the week, there was this story of a drone that was possibly fired from Gaza into Israel. That story has sort of vanished in the wake of subsequent events. Does that alarm you? Have you heard anything about that? Does that change the game in any way?
Well, you know, there are a lot of drones that are in the hands now of both states and non-state actors. Most of them are not armed yet, but the Iranians have drones. The Chinese have drones. And it's only a matter of time, given the fact that the technology is not extraordinarily complex, before you'll see much more of this.
And at the end of the hour, we come back to that issue where we started, the foreseen, unforeseen consequence of proliferation of high-tech weaponry in both of these cases, in Gaza and in the downing of the Ukrainian plane. David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.